the following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
I think you'll understand. Then I'll say this something. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. Oh, please say to me and let me be your friend. And please say to me, you'll let me hold your hand. Now let me hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. And when I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love I can hide, I can hide, I can hide. Oh, yeah, you got the something. I think you'll understand. And when I say that something, I want to hold your hand. 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 I want to hold your hand.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Capella.
It's a jungle out there. Disorder and confusion everywhere. No one seems to care. Well, I do. Hey, who's in charge here? It's a jungle out there. Poison in the very air we breathe. You know what's in the water that you drink? Well, I do. It's amazing. People think I'm crazy, 'cause I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, all this world we love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now, but I don't think so, 'cause there's the jungle out there. There's the jungle out there.
Frank Catolo, and I approve this e-cast.
Thank you.
Here we are. Y2K Plus 20. My name is Frank Cotolo. Man is named with orange, the title of the show. Wake up, it's night. Never meant it more. Truly the bard of broadcasting, creating this wonderful radio that you are welcome to listen to from here, and all the great stations that put it together during this pandemic. During our let's stroll through this nightmare together, put a little aside, see what goes on, and go with it. Cap to Ice Cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello, and into every bordello. By the way, all those places are closed right now, so don't think. Well, you know, everybody is listening somewhere, as they always do. It's just not listening together. You could be listening together. You could be in a room with two people who are not so close to you. But, of course, there's a lot of families out there, and they're close to one another. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and wax poetic about these times. Though, I do remind you that a while back, and I don't know anymore how long ago it took place or what went on, but we've talked about it any number of times, about the time capsule. And this is one of those times, one of those shows, that if you're going to think about doing a time capsule and putting in a Cotolo Chronicles show, you can get it on a 80-minute CD. Put it in the, you got to put it in a case that doesn't necessarily corrode over 100 years. I don't know. They make that. I don't know. Whatever. And along with other items of this era. And you will have something that people in years and years and years from now will talk about. That's hopeful, right? I'm saying that hundreds of years from now, there will be people who look at, open up a time capsule and find items that were particular for the era in which the capsule was buried. And you can never be sure, because a time capsule, I mean, even if it's a, you know, metal box of some kind of whatever, it doesn't necessarily have to be a capsule, although it could be. I don't know how they make those things, but as soon as stores open again, you can go by. Maybe, for all you know, this is going to be a big item now. And you can find a way to put many items in there that have to do with this era. And people will look back and hear people talking, as Adi and I did last week, Y2K Plus 20. I got to give dates and everything now. It's going to be in the time capsule from about COVID-19, COVID-19. If there's a dash in it, there's a dash. And as we are amid this time, and there's no doubt about the fact that that has invaded every angle of our lives. So this is a good time to think about putting one of these shows. You know, it doesn't cost you anything. When have I ever charged anyone to listen or to record and listen again before there were podcasts? People would use little tape recorders. That's right. What? Cassettes? What the hell is that? Welcome to the wonderful radio. And it continues. Hopefully. But I spent some time a couple of hours before this show went live talking to a good friend of mine who's in the thick of it. Because right now, what did they call it? No, it's not Target Zero. They call it the epicenter or whatever. Right now, New York, especially New York City, is under siege from COVID-19. And, you know, dashes, when you talk, if you don't say dash, right? You don't know. The lawyer says COVID-19. You don't think to put a dash in it. I'm sure you're worried about punctuation at this point in history. But I'm talking to a friend of mine, really, I mean, very right in the middle of it. And he's talking to me about, well, you know, you're probably okay where you're located. You know, it's not, nothing like being here, you know, in Manhattan, in the thickness of density and the dense thickness of people and sickness and everything else. And I'm like, no, you'd be surprised. And I think a lot of people don't know this or not aware of this. But even in a rural area where, you know, there has been contact and there are people, not many, from where I'm broadcasting who have been affected or are affected. And still, everyone reacts as if they are in those areas of major attack. And he was shocked. He said, well, you're kidding me. I said, no, I'm not kidding you. The first week, as quarantine was coming upon us, or when it did come upon us and first came upon us, you know, the local giant supermarket was crammed with people getting everything they possibly could. And what would these people have done if they were in somewhere like New York or in Washington State when it started, or any other city that's now being trampled? And so still there are, you know, empty shelves everywhere. It doesn't matter. Rural people, this has been a psychological attack as much as it's been a physical attack, and continues to be that. From, you know, you have to listen to the news. You have to listen to people talking about it on wherever news, I guess, you know, wherever you read it. And, cause you have to know what's going on. And there's local news and stuff so that you know what's happening locally. You gotta figure, you know, and so you hear just about everything, and you hear a lot of speculation because there's so much unknown at the moment. And what's running wild is something that we haven't not, I got to, haven't not, hey, what are you talking about? All of a sudden you're fine. Look at Italy, huh? Hey, something they don't have a hold of there with their hand, you know, something that's gotten away from everyone. Granted, a lot of it has been the fault of people who did not, you know, who were loose about it. And what have you that. But you know what I'm saying? What I'm saying is you go to these areas, like we were talking about Montana, my friend and I. Montana with a population under 1 million people. This is the third largest state in the union. Last I remember. Not going to tell you that this morning I did research. I did not. But, you know, this is, that's why it has so few electoral votes, right? And, so now, if there's not a lot of activity there, it's also because there's not a lot of people there, and a lot of people did not cross the borders to go to Montana. Hey, let's go to Montana and hang out. There's not a lot of people there anyway. So it means there's not a lot of stores. There's not a lot of, activity. There's no density of people. The mountains and things and plains, beautiful place. But, you know, so what? If you, right? And it's going to reach, I know what I'm going to say is this. I'll bet you dollars to donuts, and you buy the donuts, that there were people in the little stores, or they must have some supermarkets there. What's Butte, Montana? That's the capital. Butte, Montana. There must have been people in stores in Butte, Montana filling up their shopping carts to bring them home. Even though I don't even know if there is a quarantine in Montana. I don't know much about Montana. But that's a good example. So my friend is saying, wow, I'm shocked. You know, he didn't think, he figured, well, you know, we're walking around, na-dee-dee-da, you know. And granted, I don't, you know, I live a life as a loner and I live alone and I work out of my home anyway. So you'd say like, well, that doesn't have any effect on you technically. Well, it does. It has far reaching tentacles. This little round ball with the Shrek horns coming out of it, this thing, this red, and then it's blue, then it's green. Oh my God. This thing that's there. So we're all affected, and we're all more connected to the experience than anyone thinks about in another location. And that's one of the things that makes us so self-conscious. This is the world, okay? The world is going through this. Okay, even when they had, and there's no more, there's not going to be Olympics, right? So, but that's the World Olympics. I'm surprised it took them so long to decide that groups of people from various nations, maybe 100 or more nations, will all gather in the same area where they will eat, bathe, sweat, and do sport, right? And for how many days? And all the people who went to see him would be there, because you could see there's audiences. I know, I've been to Olympics. And all that, and what? You know, that's what good is going to come from that, huh? No. Well, that should have been like the first thing, right? First of all, no Olympics. Forget it. These people are coming in from everywhere. I don't care how talented they are. I don't care how high they could jump. You know, or how far they can jump on one of those broad jump things, or how much they can tumble, or how much they can bounce balls, or I don't know. Well, let you know. That's one of those things. But I hope you all stay safe and wash your hands and, you know, the regular stuff. I don't have to tell you stuff, because you know you have been, as much as I have been, reading, watching, and talking to other people about this. Maybe you haven't done it on the radio as I've done it, but what that matter? And don't pay attention to everything you hear either. If I'm going to say anything editorially, editorial tonight, it's that stuff that the lieutenant governor of, where was he, Mississippi, and Glenn Beck said that, so he's Glenn Beck was on radio, and he said, I would rather die. Let the old people go out and do stuff. We'd rather die and take it all. You know, they're going to take bullets for the young people so that their world will be free of this and everything. So let us older people go. Meanwhile, he's doing the show from his house. He's not even at the studio. Maybe he always does. I don't even know that. But, you know, and then the governor said that. The guy in Florida, DeSantis, said, you know, hey, what's the big deal? You know, let people walk around. Okay, fine. Okay. All right. When you hear these things, don't be so influenced. Be safe first. Because a lot of these people, under the circumstances of giving their opinion to anything at all, no less a major health hazard called a pandemic. And it's not a global pandemic. Remember that. It's a pandemic. Global, worldwide, universal. It's built into the word. That goes for you people in the press, too. Not everyone knows anything. I think, and I like to do this, I like to go on the premise that I don't know anything, and either the person I'm talking to doesn't know anything. And even when it's somebody I know knows something, that's why I ask questions. It is a jungle out there. You take care of yourself, but I'm not going to sit here and pontificate or make you more worried or self-conscious about the situation. Even though I am the third man, the vegetable man, the bard of broadcasting, which is fascinating because William Shakespeare himself, who was the original bard, I don't know where bard comes from, I'll look it up sometime, but he was the bard, and I'm the bard of broadcasting, he's the bard of plays and classical English language, drama and comedy, whatever, okay, theater, drama. Wrote some of his best works while in quarantine. And if you think this is bad, you do some research on the bubonic plague. It's specifically bubonic plague. There have been plagues, and there have been, you know, locusts that have eaten up entire fields of wheat and people's faces and what have you through the years. But the bubonic plague, which is bubonic because of the bubes that developed in a person's skin, bubes they called them, these hideous lumps that came from the fleas on rats. The bubonic plague, 1600s. When you walked through the streets and there were carts of bodies, carts of dead bodies being rolled through, and I don't know how anybody got through it, but the bard did. And maybe a lot of it was the quarantine. Maybe he had a certain immunity or a good immune system. And I hope you have one too. So I'm not going to tell you about this stuff and talk about it. I'm just telling you, don't listen to what everybody says and ask questions. Don't ever think they're stupid. And maybe you've heard that before too, but you know, it makes sense. But you know, wash your hands, of course. Of course, wash your hands. This is something that I hope when we get out of this, everyone gets a sense of doing that anyway, because it's just good. All right. Now, what am I going to do here? I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. So as opposed to doing this or rolling my tongue off to some other particular subject, I'm going to satisfy a request for a classic Cotolo. And I'm going to play for you pretty much all of an interview. The man named Philip Margot, who I hope is doing well. He's a Brooklynite, as I am. I hope he's doing well out there. Philip Margot was a member of a group, pop group. You can't say rock. I guess it was all rock and roll. A member of a group called The Tokens. And they are known for a song that has become iconic. It's become well-known, popular in so many ways, based on a tribal African tune. And the song, which was the record, which was a huge hit, called The Lion Sleeps Tonight. Philip Margot was a member of The Tokens. His late brother, Mitch Margot, was also a member, and I don't know the other guys. But in 2012, Margot, Phil, wrote a book, science fiction book. He was getting into writing. And he had him on the show, and of course, we talked about The Lion Sleeps Tonight and that whole era, which we were not aware that we ever rubbed shoulders during that time. When I was in the music business and he was still in the music business, The Tokens, and we're going to talk about that. We did talk about that. We had a really good time talking about that. And someone asked about the song because I'll tell you why, because there's a documentary that was going around. It was either on Netflix or Prime Flix or, right, or, you know, Video Flix or wherever, Hulu, Yulu, Dulu, and about people get the royalties to this particular song, which date back to, I don't know what they date back to, but as I said, historically goes back to, poor tribal people. But anyway, someone had seen that and, looked through our Cotolo Chronicles at, .blogspot.com, which you could do too, and found a picture of Margot saying, hey, this is the guy, you know, and as I tell you all, if you do that and you write to me at fcotolo@yahoo.com, I will, if I can, find the show, and if we have it recorded, we can play parts of it, these specific parts of it, and that's what we're going to do. That's what I'm going to do. We're going to go back, let's see, that would be what, 8 years to Cotolo Chronicles back then, and I'm going to have to cue it up, of course, which I'm going to do right now. Okay. All right, you don't need that. I'm going to cue it up right now, and while I cue it up, I'm going to tell you that this is a very good time. I hate to make a commercial I hate to make this into a commercial. I don't know why. Why do I feel guilty? I'm taking advantage of the fact a lot of people say, I tell you this anyway. What's the difference? Go get the books. You know where my books are located. You know where you could find all the books of all the people who have written books. And when you hear about this book, you could find it too somewhere. Go there and buy the books. Put them on whatever you put them on. You buy them in digital form and read them. It's a good time to be reading. I emphasize reading. I encourage reading. And I think you should be reading. Yeah, so there's that. Okay? What will happen next week, we don't know. We'll just keep trying to be here and do what we have to do. But I'll come back. I'll come back after we have done a little bit of this. I'm trying to... It's so touchy to try to, 30, I'll try to, get the exact, I guess 30, 31 is as far as I can go, huh? 30, 20? No, that's less. Oh, 31, that's less. 30, 15? No. A little bit, 30, 48 will work. That's perfect. I have queued it up to the exact moment when I call Mr. Phil Margot, and you're going to hear that. And then I will come back and we will talk about whatever and we'll say goodbye. But there's plenty of time for that too. Listen to this. It's a fascinating story and it's really a piece of neo-postmodernism that a traditional, you know, song, which is not even a song, a tune, a melody makes its way to people doing pop music who put words to it. And rearrange it and make it into I don't even know if I played the song on here. I hope a lot of you know what that song sounds like, but you'll hear it. And you'll go look at it later like you do with everything else we do not annotate. You write it down, write this down, and then you find out about it. The song is The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and the production is unequaled and certainly classic. And the man is Philip Margot. My name is Frank Atolo. The man whose name adorns the title of this show and the show that you're going to hear from 2012. Oh, my God. Way back when. See, this is good, too. If you use this show, you get that stuff about the COVID-19. And you'll get all this stuff, too. If you haven't heard it, I'm sure a lot of you haven't. And those of you who have, do you really remember it? Hello? No. Okay. So let's do it. And then what happens, happens. Here I am from there and getting in touch with Phil Margot.
Second here. In a world where reading is dying out, a new champion emerges.
Oh, look. And it's not to the commercial. Oh, well, here we go.
Universes.
Hello, everyone. This is me, Frank Atolo.
There's never a dull moment as Frank weaves a tale of a writer making you laugh, chuckle, and learn a bit about life. Pick up License to Scale by Frank Atolo, now on Amazon for your Kindle.
Okay, that worked. That worked. Okay, so now what I'm going to do...
Oh. Hello?
Hey, there you go. I hear you.
You hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, and here I am.
Oh, great.
I didn't have the audio input on built-in microphone.
Okay. No. Are you hearing me, or is there any static or anything? Are you okay?
Oh, you sound as clear as a bell.
Great. Because when I sound like a bell, I'm really happy.
You do. You sound great. Wait, let me just focus down a bit. There I am.
No one
make it bigger, but I here I am.
That's okay. I'm able to look at you. You're not able to look at me. No one else is looking at you, but it's okay to have you on there because I feel more like you're a member of this show when you're there because I could see you.
Happy to be here.
I kept thinking somewhere along the line, you and I might have met or been on around the same area. Did you work with the Tokens or some form or shape of the Tokens for many years?
I have been the Tokens since 1961, and we perform all the time.
Okay, so then
called the Tokens. Jay Siegel is Jay Siegel's Token.
Oh, that's why when I was looking at pictures, so Jay was with you guys, but then he went off to be Jay Siegel's token.
Jay was one of the originals, and I moved out here with my brother Mitch, who was one of the originals, and we started a group out here, and Jay performs in New York. He performs all over as well. Like, we're going to be in Buffalo next week, you know.
I used to tell people that, and they didn't understand this. I used to tell people that that the Drifters, the Drifters are tonight at this show that I'm doing with some other people here in San Diego, and the Drifters are also in Ann Arbor, Michigan tonight, and they're also in San Diego. No, they're in San Diego. They're in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They're also in Crete, Illinois. People don't understand that that there was actually kind of a franchise for a lot of these older groups. Because I used to call them, like, the same thing with the Coasters and the Drifters. I used to call them the Drifting Coasters and the Coasting Drifters. You never knew who you were getting, you know?
None of them are real. None of them are real. My brother and I are two of the original Token.
That's what I mean. People don't understand that.
I have the 70 years to prove it.
Wow. Well, you look good for 70. I hope I look that good at 70.
I take my glasses off because I don't need them. But if any group goes on stage and can read without these, they're not the original group.
Yeah, I know. That's for sure. Well, you know, you would think people, I always thought that people might get a clue when they saw the Drifters, right? And it was one guy, maybe two guys who had a certain age that pretty much stamped the fact that they were at least of the era. And then the other guys were young, you know? And it's like, wait a second, doesn't anybody know what's going on here? They don't care.
It's kind of first of all, I think it's dishonest. I don't approve of it. I think it's wrong. I think if they call themselves tribute groups, at least it's close to the truth. When they try to represent themselves as the group itself, that's, to me, fraudulent.
Well, I think a lot of the tribute groups become tribute groups and actually say they're tribute groups because, I mean, ultimately, everyone identifies with a lot of the people. In other words, if I walked into four men on the street and they were original members of the Coasters, even having worked with them, I really don't remember any of them. And the Temptations, you might know one or two guys. In other words, they weren't as identifiable as like Eric Clapton or, you know, or John Lennon, or, you know, so you'd know.
That's right. But truth is truth.
Truth is truth. You're right.
People go to see somebody perform and they're represented to be at least one person to be with the original group. Then there's a certain amount of truth legality to it. You know, when they represented themselves as somebody who they're not, that's wrong. You know,
I'm just telling these younger people who listen that you better watch it because you just don't know if you're getting an authentic Drifters or Coasters or anything that when you go out there and get that. Now, Tokens, but you guys have two groups. I mean, Jay goes out and does, his Tokens do.
Jay is called Jay Siegel's Tokens, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We are the Tokens.
Without Jay Siegel.
When Jay stops performing, there will be nobody else but us.
Okay. So I don't want to get technical about this. Maybe it's none of my business, but who owns the name?
We do.
Oh, okay.
Mitch and I own it.
But he can use the Tokens.
Well, how could he not? It wouldn't be right. It's the, you know why? It's
what?
The truth.
Okay.
You know, it's the truth. Now, when he would represent the other two guys as original Tokens, that got us a little hot under the collar, you know, because they weren't, you know, and I don't represent the fellows who play with us other than myself and my brother as the original group.
Now, you're a Brooklyn guy like me. I do an awful lot of shows about that rat hole, that mausoleum of a city, the third largest city in the world, that place. Where exactly is your Brooklyn trotting? Where did you trot around in Brooklyn?
I grew up in Brighton Beach, and right now today, Brooklyn is like the new downtown Manhattan. You know, it's like. It's a very, very rich area because a lot of people who can't afford to live in Manhattan itself because the prices are absurd live in Brooklyn.
Where the prices are equally difficult.
Not as bad. No walk through the daisy, but not as bad as they are in Manhattan.
Yeah, Yeah, it's really, I keep wondering, in this economy or any economy, what did these people do? You know, I heard they did, you remember the Gowanus Canal?
Sure.
Okay, well, they apparently there's all sorts of, like, condos and...
Yes, it's becoming a very built-up. Williamsburg is coming up as well. And it's all going to be, like, little boutique areas, you know?
I have a friend who lives in Williamsburg, and I told her, I said, you know, I couldn't go to Williamsburg without an automatic weapon when I was a kid.
Well, you're right. Right. Or you had to be Jewish.
Well, yeah, okay. You're right. That's right. There was that whole Hasidic... Oh, wow, that's right. That's where that whole...
Well, the Lubavitch are there. It still is.
Yeah.
Rabbi Schneerson and all of them, they're still there. Or I don't think he is, but, you know, that whole sect is there. But now it's all different.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, that.
A lot of the people who listen to us are of that ilk. They're that age. They're that, you know, because they were all very computer savvy from the beginning. And we've been here from the beginning of internet radio. And so they've learned a lot about this pop culture since they've been here, because I've had many guests and some, of course, like you, who were there from the beginning. Why don't you tell? So you're there in Brooklyn with a bunch of guys singing. How does it happen? How do the tokens come about for people who may have only know that one song or don't know you at all?
Okay. First of all, I got to tell you, I was a very unspectacular kid. I had no visible talent whatsoever. I didn't care much about school. I cared about mainly being a kid when I was a kid. I played ball, built model airplanes, and occasionally, you know, spent some time with a lady, you know. But basically, up until my junior year of high school, I was pretty much zero.
What high school were you going to in Brighton Beach?
Abraham Lincoln High School.
Okay.
And like many people in this world, it was a teacher for me who was a music teacher at Lincoln. Her name was Mrs. Kate Durakis. And I had a music appreciation class in my junior year, and she decided to start a boys chorus. And she decided that every boy in the class of every one of our classes would have to try out for the boys chorus. Now, Brooklyn Boys Chorus, you could see how well that was going to go over,
right?
I
know, right.
Okay. My brother, in our show, we call it the Wussy Boys Chorus.
Yeah.
What happened was, she brought me up on stage and she sang some notes and she played some notes on the piano and I sang them. Wow. She said, just sing them. And I sang notes and she's played more intricate combinations and I sang those. And she looked at me and she said, Philip, you have a remarkable ear. And that was the first time a teacher ever used Philip and remarkable in the same sentence.
You said the first. I'm sure there were many, many more times.
That was the first. And I joined the boys' chorus. We did our first concert, and it was amazing to sit in the middle of all that harmony. It was beautiful. You know, it was, oh, my God. It's like when it goes through your ears and they vibrate, and you say, oh, my God, this is beautiful, you know.
Yeah.
And after the first concert, she asked if anybody would like to entertain at the sock hop that they were having in a month or two. And I volunteered myself and my brother. And there was a hit song at the time called All I Have to Do Is Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And we sang it at the sock hop, a cappella, just the two of us. And after we finished, the audience applauded, which was already good. And then girls came over to me.
Yeah, that closes the deal right there.
I'm Tina, you know, so on and so forth. And I'm Suzanne, and nice to meet you. And are you new here? I said, no, I've been here for 3 years, you know. I've been kind of anonymous. Anyway, that drove me to learn how to play the piano, which I did in a very short time because I didn't know I had this ability to do that.
Mm.
I taught myself the piano in about 3 months, and not like Arthur Rubin started,
sure,
but well enough to start a little band.
Sure.
We worked in the Catskills, and we had a wonderful summer in the Catskills. When I came back, my drummer's father won the New York State Lottery 2 months in a row.
Wait a second. What year is this? The lottery? Is that, what do you mean?
This was in 59. Yes, there was a lottery.
There wasn't a real lottery?
Yeah, it was worth $100,000.
The New York State Lottery?
Yeah.
I think the lottery came until later.
No. Check it out. One or two years. If it didn't, then my memory is very strange.
Well, I know there were illegal lotteries, yeah.
No, no, this was a legitimate lottery.
Okay, all right, just go ahead. That's fine.
You can check it.
All
right. You can have somebody on your staff check it. What staff? All right. Anyway.
That's why I'm remarkable.
I know. So anyway, he won the lottery, and the guy had to leave the band. And I found the replacement, and the replacement we found knew Hank Medras. And I met Hank, and that's how we got together. And we wound up writing some stuff and trying to get a break, and nothing happened. And then we sang together for the first time on December 7th, 1959, Hank and myself and Mitch. We sang the background to Teenager in Love, and it sounded great.
For Deanna Belmont? Wow. You mean for... Oh, you sang the background. Now, you weren't on the record with Deanna Belmont.
Oh, sang the background with the piano.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
Just see how the three of us would sound as a group.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
And then we wrote Tonight I Fell in Love, and we got a hold of Jay, and Jay sang the lead, and the rest happened. You know, the rest happened. We in fact, Hank met a woman on a train whose son was a producer, and she was the one who produced, they produced our first record.
Obviously, when you say you met a woman on the train and that has something to do with success, I think, is that where somebody came up with the calling of the tokens?
No.
Where did the tokens come from? It had to come from the subway, or didn't it?
No. We were called those guys originally. We wanted to call ourselves those guys.
Those guys. Huh?
Those guys. Here they are, ladies and gentlemen.
Those guys. Well,
really cool, right?
Well, what happened?
Well, Morty Kraft, who was the guy at the label who bought Tonight I Fell in Love to release, threatened not to release it because he didn't like the name Those Guys. He thought it was too weird. And he had recorded Neil Sedaka on Melba Records at the time. So he said, you know, earlier, a couple of years previous, and he said, well, why don't we use the name The Token? And we just wanted our record out. So that's how we got the name The Token. It had nothing to do with anything, but we had to call ourselves something, and we wanted to get the record out, and we had to acquiesce.
I'm just always interested in the details about how these things come about. They're always great stories.
It was out of necessity. It wasn't, you know, I mean, we would have loved to call ourselves Those Guys, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, I can't imagine. That sounds like something a record producer in those days would have said. Those guys, we can't do that. That sounds perfectly okay, but a good story, and it's good that it's not The Tokens from The Tokens, Brooklyn Trains and Tokens, because that's the obvious one. Okay, so what was the name of this label?
Warwick.
Warwick is the original label.
Yes, it was a Canadian company. Seven Arts was the name of the company, and Warwick was a division.
Oh, they're the ones who went with Warner Brothers at one point.
Right. Well, but that was afterwards. Yeah. So the record got on the charts, and it was in the top 15.
Now, which record is this now?
Tonight I Fell in Love.
Probably, you guys out there, you could probably go to YouTube, I'm sure, and find this somewhere, right? Yeah.
But at any rate, it got to the top 15, and we went to Morty and asked him for an advance, you know, on our royalties. And he said, there are no royalties, the record's still in the red.
Wow, now we're talking about the stuff that happened.
So we said, well, how could that be? I mean, you know, we're within the top 15. We must have sold some records. And he went through this whole thing about why there was no money. And we said, well, we're going to go to RCA. And he said, what could I do for you that RCA can't? And we said, pay us.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, give us our royalties.
We answered the question spontaneously, all together, pay us. And we went to RCA, and then The Lion Sleeps Tonight came out. And we decided that because there was nowhere to work for a group like us. In other words, we weren't really a folk group. We didn't want to do clubs, you know, those seedy nightclubs where you're dressed in the beverage room. And we didn't like to do those tours because we had families and we didn't like it. And they were awful. You know, six shows a day, you could go crazy from that, you know.
Do you guys go ahead.
So we decided to become producers.
Now, were you like a band singing, or did you just have backup guys for the records and stuff, or that when you went out and played somewhere, or what? Or were you guys playing, would you play on the records? Did you do stuff? What?
We didn't play on our original, on the Tokens' original records, but I played drums on a lot of the records we produced that were hits, and we played our own, we were our own band.
Okay, that's what
so
I meant.
So we started going out. Even working in a few places, we found that the bands couldn't play the stuff right. So we decided, since I already could play the piano and my brother could already play the guitar, we decided to learn how to play ourselves. And that's what we did. And we accompanied ourselves and do till this day.
Now, you went over to RCA. Was there an A&R man that found this old song? Tell us the history of the evolution. I know you've said this a billion times, but you know it. We don't. So you tell us again. Where does the lion sleep tonight? Where does this thing get into your hands?
Okay. We had made some demos, and Jay, who has and had a very eclectic taste in music. He loved country. He loved folk. You know, he really had a much broader taste than we had at the time. Had this song from the Weavers, which was recorded in 1952, called Wimoweh. And though we never heard the record, he taught us the song, and we did a demo on it, which I just found not too long ago. We did a demo at Allegro Studios in New York City. And when we went to RCA, we submitted it along with, you know, when we were going to go to RCA. And the producers, Hugo and Luigi, said, we like it very much. We want to do it, but it needs a lyric. Because the original Wimoweh was just the chant.
Right.
So we laid out the record pretty much as it is on the demo to a great degree. We realized it was a demo with only a bongos and an organ. But it gave the flavor of what the record eventually became. Sammy Lowe, of course, wrote a beautiful arrangement with the high soprano and the soprano sax solo and all of that stuff and the timpani drums. I mean, he turned it into a real wonderful thing, Sammy did. And Anita Darien is the high soprano voice who that helped make the record as well. And we showed up at the session at RCA Studios in July of 1961, I think near the end of July, and they handed us a lyric. In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, quiet jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. And we said, what the hell is this? You know, this is ridiculous. What is the melody we're supposed to sing? And they said, you sing the same thing as the chant. And then we said, but if you sing the same thing, that means the melody is repeated six or seven times. It would be boring. So after the first rundown, we went over to the piano to work out a different melody to go with the lyric. And while we did that, Anita Darien walked over to Sammy Lowe, and Sammy Lowe was the arranger, and Sammy said, look, that soprano part isn't working right. And Anita said, well, let me do it an octave higher. So at that moment, two things happened. The melody was born, and the fact that that wonderful soprano obbligato in the background, which gives you that real jungle feeling, okay, became right. An octave higher, which really gave it that wonderful, you know, cutting sound. And so two very important things. And so we actually wrote the melody, although we didn't get credit or paid. Yeah. We wrote the melody for that segment of the song.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize how much input goes to people who are not credited on songs, whether they become classics or not. That certainly, like I said, is one of the landmarks on the map of pop culture, because everyone knows it.
Yeah, it wasn't a matter of not being credited. It was a matter of being screwed over.
but
I mean, when you write a melody,
who got the credit? I used always looked at records and saw who got the credit for writing them. You know all the stories because you were there. There, you know, it was no Norman Petty, but they had to get someone had to get Buddy Holly's money with them and split it. You know, all that junk. Who got the credit for The Lion Sleeps Tonight? What does it say? Traditional, or does it someone's name on there?
Oh, Hugo and Luigi and George David Weiss, who wrote the lyric.
Okay.
And Solomon Lindo, who wrote the original chant. Finally, see, we should have gotten credit, and we should have gotten a piece of it because we actually wrote it, and they admitted it, but yeah. It never happened.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. That's
But it was a great thing for us, you know. I mean, it resounds even today. They have this card. Wait, hold on. Wait, just 1 second.
Okay, he's now getting up. He's got a seat very much like mine.
I just want to show you.
He's walking across. Please show me and I'll describe it.
It's a card.
A Hallmark card. It's a card, yeah. A greeting card.
It says, and it's a graduation card, and it says, out of the zoo into the jungle, right?
Right.
It's out now, and when you open it up.
Oh.
Okay.
One of those talking cards with a little digital thing.
That's today. That's 51 years ago.
Well, like I said, there's no doubt about the fact that this particular recording has become immortal in its own sense. And we know, could you even count? I didn't go look at it, but I'm sure that there are many, many movies since this thing arrived that use this, So I don't know if they use the original. Maybe they do use your original track in it. There must be a ton of movies.
Yes, a lot of movies, a Nike commercial with Kobe and LeBron James.
Yeah.
All kinds of stuff, yeah. We do get, we still get royalties from RCA, now it's Sony. It's funny, Sony bought RCA and Columbia. RCA and Columbia were two greatest rivals. Now they're under the same roof.
Yeah, I think there's only four, if that many, major corporations running the whole show now.
Yeah, I know, it's true.
Yeah. So things were different then, a lot of people don't understand how these mechanics worked. Okay, so this thing comes out, and it's a big hit. Obviously, it's a big hit. And how do you guys go? You got to go live and do this stuff. How do you recreate it? Are you just not showing up on American Bandstand lip syncing? Are you going actually playing this song anywhere?
Well, there wasn't a lot of places to work, but when we did work, yes, of course. We played it live, and it worked fine.
It did. So even without the elaborate backing and the various things that went on there,
right,
that go on in it, you did it.
Yeah, because the main part of the record is the chant and the noodling and the lyric. And that was easy enough to recreate.
You had another advantage, too, in that it was so recognizable and people knew it so much and were singing along that they weren't about to stand there and go, hey, wait a second, I don't hear that orchestration. They were just singing along, right, and just having a ball. They didn't care. They weren't going to be critical.
You know, and that's something that you said, that you just said that, and it's interesting because when I was this unspectacular kid growing up, I would investigate and break down music that I heard, going back as far as like Dorsey and Doris Day and Dinah Shore singing with Xavier Cugat and all of those artists and Glenn Miller, and I would break it down and examine it. What are the trumpets doing? What are the violins doing? And I never realized that it was that not everybody did that. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah,
That should have given me a clue that I had some interest in music. But all it did was, I just listened to music.
Did you have any idea what you wanted to be before this all started? Or did, what was?
No.
No.
I wanted to be, it was a short time I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer because I loved airplanes and I loved flying. But then I was given a rude awakening when I found out that you had to use math.
Oh boy.
Huh? And when I ran up against trigonometry, I said, whoa, and that's so basic. So I said, all right, I'm not a mathematician, so I ain't going to be an engineer.
Philip Margot, not Philip Marlowe, the detective, is with us here live on As We Chronicle. I say that because I just kept saying Marlowe, and it's not Marlowe, it's Margot. Philip Margot.
It actually was Margulies.
Margulies. I was going to say, how did it change Italian-wise?
No, it wasn't Italian.
Oh, it wasn't Italian. So what are you?
No, it's Margalit. It's Hebrew.
Jewish. Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
It's Margalit, and it means pearl. And my father changed it, not me. I would have kept it the way it was. I mean, there are plenty of people named Margulies that are very successful. But it's Margot. That's what it is. It's easy to write, I will tell you that.
Yeah, that's for sure. So if we move along here now, we see that, how long can you be here? Can you be here until we're done here?
Yes.
Okay. So what we usually do at the end, we're almost over the first hour here. I usually do is, we all take a break. Everybody goes, gets their drinks and stuff. And I run a couple of PR stuff and some, little advertisements here. And then we come back. How about we do that? We'll start that there right now. And then we'll come back with you. I want to talk about what happens after that, the rest of the music career, and of course the books and the writing, because we do that. We share that also, you and I. Although I'm not remarkable.
Anytime you do something well, it's remarkable.
No, what? It is. I know. It's great. And I always enjoy.
Don't take yourself for granted. What I mean?
Yeah.
Never do that. Don't overestimate yourself, but never take yourself for granted. Everybody can do something well.
Thank you. Philip Margo is with us, and he also, and I don't want to talk about science fiction and stuff or whatever else you do writing, because apparently your shelves there are just jam-packed with all sorts of stuff there. You've been doing a lot of work over these years, and it doesn't have to do with Wemoweps.
No, not at all.
So I'm going to take a break, maybe go to the bathroom, get yourself another beverage or something, and then everybody else, they know what's going on because they listen all the time. We'll be back in like 7 minutes, and Philip Margo is going to stay with us here to the end, here on as we continue to chronicle Philip Margo, author, songwriter, singer, musician, you know, the whole works. We got
a bunch of stuff.
Don't go away, and don't turn that thing off now, and you'll just hear a whole bunch of junk going on in the background. And we'll be okay with that, okay?
I'll be right here.
Okay, we shall be right back.
This is Joe Walsh. I'm speaking on behalf of Rad. It's okay to rock and roll, right? But don't drive home drunk. If you're drunk, call me up. I have a limo. I'll come and get you.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, Rad, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Would it be crazy if you just stopped everything, packed your bags and left for a week, a month, a year? What if you left for 2 years? Would people think you'd lost your mind? What if you were going far away to help in a village on the edge of the Gobi Desert? A village crowded with Buddhist temples, not skyscrapers. A place where there isn't a word for recluse, but 1,000 words for community. Would it be crazy to go 5,000 miles from home? To spend time with people the rest of the world only reads about. To build libraries and fill them with stories. Prepare a meal with food you helped grow. To teach children and learn a thing or two about yourself. Would that be crazy? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
Hi, I'm Julian Lennon. Are you in the band? Join me and Band Together for Lupus to support the Lupus Foundation of America and its efforts to provide research, education and support for all people living with lupus. Visit lupus.org to learn more about this chronic disease affecting 1.5 million Americans and find out how to join the band today.
I want to tell you to do one thing, though, and if you'll pay attention to me, it might save your life. I want you to buckle up and live. Seatbelts and shoulder harnesses can be your second chance. Now, if you never had an accident, you could be next, because you gamble every time you get in your car. Now, you cut down the odds against you getting killed, you understand, by buckling up your seatbelt or your harness. Use them as advised by your car's manufacturer, and have your passengers use them, too. Automobile accidents can be deadly. Be sure you get that second chance. Buckle up and live.
Everybody. everybody's voting for the friendly voice of radio, the people's choice. Music, weather, sports, and news, it's radio. The people choose. Everybody's swinging to the swinging voice of radio, the people's choice. Big fry, small fry, dawn to dawn, it's radio. The turns them on, swinging.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
And it continues right here as we chronicle through Y2K plus 12 here in I'm Frank Atoll. A man's name is doing the title of the show, and with me, a cohort of sorts, a man who has been around the block. Where are you in there in California? You know, I used to live out there a long time. Are you in Beverly Hills?
Yep.
Wow. Wow. How's things changed out there over the past decade? I know it's a loaded question, right?
No. It got more crowded. When I first moved out here in 1978, there was more open. It was, you know.
That's exactly the year I went there, 1978.
Yeah, it was more open. There was, you know, there was some land, you know, everywhere has gotten very difficult. I mean, we're in a very difficult time in this country. It's a pivotal time. I frankly, for the first time in my 70 years, think this country could go either way. It could go really south. And I see it in municipalities. I see it in the people that are running the show, who are there because of money, not because of a desire to be a good leader or to help people. And, you know, I mean, I know this, you don't do politics, but you asked me a question about Beverly Hills. I think it was a much more citizen-oriented city when I moved in. Now it's all about business, and it's all about everything but the people. And so is the rest of the country. I mean, you know, there's a reason for what's going on now. But aside from that, I love it out here. I love it out here. I have 8 grandchildren out here. I have 3 children. I'm married for 45 years to the same woman. And I'll stay married another 45 if she'll have me. And, I have, my grandkids are marvelous. They're the most treasured thing I ever did or ever had or ever will do or have, you know, and they're not perfect. None of them. But they're mine, and I love them.
Well, sounds like whatever's going on out there and on out there in the world ain't affecting you much because you're having a grand old time, and that's the way it should be.
Well, what the hell? I mean, if you can't, you know, you got to. You know.
Don't you remember, though, Phil, don't you remember in the early 50s, the late 50s and 60s, or even through the 50s, you remember the whole beatnik thing, the whole anti-establishment thing, there was always this unrest going on. There was always a schism between who was liberal, who was conservative. Might have even been worse in certain ways out there. And everywhere, right? So, I mean, the things weren't, I don't want to say, I'm not even getting political. I'm just saying that all the times have their trials, all the times have their vicissitudes, and we're just going through here now, another one or two.
Except there's one thing that people... There's one thing that's true. If you look back at all of the terrible times, you'll find out that they all were based in the same problem. And that's greed. Period. End of story. Teddy Roosevelt had to deal with it in the early 1900s.
And there you go.
He had to break up the trust. The reason why there was a depression was because of greed. All of these things are linked directly to greed. And today is worse than I've ever seen it before.
Well, John, it's worse than we've ever seen it before. But I mean, in the history of mankind, I think this is a speck.
It's not a speck. A speck is when you had the bubonic plague in England.
You know, I was just going to mention that. I was saying like that's like that. You know, I mean, they lived through that.
But they didn't have it again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It didn't happen again. If it happens once, that crap happens. We had a civil war here. We had all kinds of terrible stuff. But it didn't happen again.
Right.
But what's happening now with the economy and the leadership and the insanity happened before. And the message was clear then. And it's still the same clarity now. We had 8 years of a moron in the White House who destroyed this country single-handedly. And now they're thinking of putting another one in. It's frightening to me, but that's you know, I'm doing a radio show for national cable radio start June. Can I say like
you say anything you want? It doesn't matter to me.
It's going to be called "It's Time to Stop the Bullshit," and it really deals with all the bullshit that's going on, and it's stunning. It's stunning. So you know that's something, and the reason why I'm so passionate about it is because of those eight lovelies that I talked about before that have to grow up in what's turning into a cesspool.
But it just makes you wonder how that lion sleeps, huh?
The lion is not sleeping.
He's not sleeping at night.
He's pissed off and growling. And by the way, just so you'll know, lions don't live in the jungle; they live in savannas.
Right. That's right.
It's not even correct.
I know. Isn't that, it's just amazing how legend, I was telling everyone else because I was, at the beginning of the show, because I was talking about Orson Welles, and, it's, you know, there's an old thing in journalism. There's an old saying, if the legend is better than truth, print the legend.
Right.
You know? So,
that's the problem.
So the things we know and don't know, are amazing. Okay, let's get back to pop culture, which of course equally has changed equally because we were already talking about the companies that run the place and joint and everything like that now. But, how did, I was going to go back here for 1 second and say, what happened after the lion sleeps tonight? Did someone come up to you and say like, how are you going to do that one? What are you going to do now? What happens now?
As I said, earlier on, there was nowhere to work. Okay. And the gigs were worth nothing. It was, you know, come out to the club, sing, I'll give you $300. Great. You know, whoopee. So we really had nowhere to perform. I mean, if we had a hit of that magnitude now, we would be filling up Dodger Stadium. You know what I mean?
Right.
But back then it was a different game. So we decided to become producers. We felt that we were getting married. We were starting to have families, and we decided we didn't want to schlep around the country. So we decided to become producers. And Capitol gave us a break and gave us a deal, and we spent our budget of $12,000 in 6 months and made absolute garbage. And then we're sitting in the office and we get a knock on the door, and this group comes in that wants to audition, and they didn't have an appointment, but we said, I'll come in anyway, you know, because we try to knock on doors. So we figured we'd extend the courtesy to them. And it was a group called the Chiffons. And they sang a song called He's So Fine. And we said, oh boy, we got to record this. And we blew our budget already, so we had to take them into the studio and we had to play the instruments ourselves because we couldn't afford to hire an arranger or a band or 802 guys, you know, professional musicians. So we do this thing called He's So Fine, and we run around to 12 companies and they all turn it down. And finally, Laurie decides they're going to buy it because they think it's a hit.
Wow, Laurie, I remember. I remember it was red and black. I remember the label. You said it. I can actually remember the font.
Dion and the Belmonts, the Mystics, a lot of hit records. And they bought the record, and it was, and the rest is history. Then we had One Fine Day. Then we produced Denise. Then we produced, we have a whole string of hits. The Happenings, Tony O'Leary and the Wind Dawn, just all through the whole decade.
So now you say who is this little company, you and the
original guys, Hank, Phil, Mitch, and Jay.
Okay. And that was smart thinking. That was kind of like, you guys were kind of like the guys who went out to act in Hollywood in the beginning. And they said, you know what? We got to buy some land here because, you know, because this acting stuff may dry up. Let's buy some land. Next thing you know, they'll make, that was very smart of you guys, to do that.
And we would have, I think we would have eventually could have, if things didn't happen the way they did, we could have been one of the all-time successful David Geffen kind of people. But what happened?
How come that so little is known about? I mean, I know a lot of stuff, and I was in the industry, and I know a lot of people and talk and everything. How come there's not a lot written about what happened to the Tokens after that. It seems to me, like most people go like, yeah, they did that Lion song and I never heard from them again. And, I mean, I did not know. Of all the things I know, I did not know you were involved with He's So Fine. I thought this was all some kind of Phil Spector spinoff or something. I didn't know.
I'll tell you why, because even when we were in the middle of the industry making hit records, we never got the imprimatur of the main cats in the business. Mm. The Jerry Wexlers, the Ahmet Erdogans, all of these hotshot guys that ran the major companies. Most of our success was on small labels.
Right.
Hey, yeah. Laurie, Bell, Larry Utal. I mean, our own label, The Happenings, were on, The Happenings were on BT Puppy. We were never dubbed as successes from the mainstream business. Therefore, and those same people were the ones who run the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They didn't respect us then, and they still don't.
Yeah, well, so, I did a whole show on that catastrophe, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Let's not go into that, because if you feel the way I do, it's a...
Well, I mean, we did what nobody... First of all, aside from the fact that we did things recording-wise that nobody ever did, we changed the whole way that the AFFM, the very popular musicians union, looked at recording. When we first started, you couldn't track. You couldn't make a track and then record the artist over it. You had to pay double and this and that. When we started recording and playing the instruments, we said to them, how can we be producers if we can't do track?
Yeah.
I said, we'll pay the singers, but we can't make records if I have to be in the booth and can't be outside in the booth. You know, so they changed the law. The AFFM, the powerful AFFM, changed the rule, and tracking became legal because of us, you know. And plus, we made all these hit records.
Yeah, is there still I remember having to join at one point when I was in New York.
Yeah.
But by that point, the AFM was not exactly one of your legit operations. I mean, they really went down. Is there now a union of musicians? There isn't even one now, is there?
Yes, I get a pension from them.
Okay, so well, then good. They still have they've kept that thing together, because when I was a lot of the people I was involved with, and I won't get into that. They didn't follow. It was a joke. The AFM was a joke.
Well,
back
it wasn't
in the,
a joke. It was a very powerful union. They could shut 70s, down Broadway.
Yeah.
They were very powerful, and in order to get in, you had to audition. But they had no choice but to take us because we were already working.
Yeah.
How do you say, oh, no, you can't join? All right, we won't join. We'll just do our stuff and pay and not give you any dues. Oh, never mind. You can join.
Yeah. I just mentioned, I didn't have to audition. I just mentioned Vito and I got in. But anyway, let's not get to that.
Salutations?
Yeah. Exactly. You know, you want your garbage picked up tomorrow? Or you want nothing special in your garbage?
We didn't get involved. That's another thing. We never got involved in any of that. Never touched us.
That's good. That's a good thing, because there's a lot of corruption going on there and everywhere, especially when the money was there. And is the Brill Building still there?
Oh, yeah.
Is it still there? I wonder what's in the Brill Building. Certainly not music publishers.
Same thing, except we were able to go upstairs when we were first starting and knock on doors.
Yeah, how could there be music publishers that can afford an office in Manhattan anymore? I mean, publishing, the whole thing has changed. Everything has changed.
There's no record business anymore.
Right.
The record business as we know it. Tell me, what's your favorite record that you heard last year?
The record business. Well, I don't get records anymore, but I know what you're gonna say.
There's nothing. Yeah. We used to have one every week. Sure. Something came out. You said, wow, did you hear? You've Lost That Love and Feeling. Right. Did you hear Runaway? Did you hear, a million? I mean, I can go on and on and on. I mean, we were a subject. Did you hear The Lion Sleeps Tonight?
Right.
Did
right.
you hear He's So Fine? Did you hear, whatever it was, Tie Yellow Ribbon? I mean, and all the other records that came out. There was a hubbub about the record business. Then when the internet came in, they all said, oh, the internet is going to kill us. And I said, no, it's not. It's another channel of trade. Don't you get it? It's another place to sell records. And they didn't get it.
No, the whole record industry.
I kept saying, guys, you don't understand. This is another way to sell records.
You got some foresight there, too. When this show when broadband first began, that was one of the big things that was up for grabs. That's when Hillary Rosen was the head of the RIAA. Do you remember that? Back that far, Hillary Rosen, the one who's the Democrat who's, or not Democrat, I don't know. She was in the news recently.
And what she said was perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, but let's not talk about that. I mean, back then, she was among those, the people who wanted to come in and, you know, get kids who were downloading and send them off to prison for downloading. The RIAA did not handle it correctly. Nobody handled it correctly. You're right. They didn't see it.
They treated it as a crime, and right. It wasn't. Right. When you were, I don't know how, are you my age or younger?
You got me by about 8-9 years.
Okay, so did you ever tape stuff off the radio?
Oh, absolutely. We've done tons of shows about it. Yeah, yeah.
What's the big deal? And I said to them, you think that this is inventing it? Yeah. I said, but now it's instant, and you could sell it. You can charge for it. What's the matter with you people? And they didn't get it. They fought it.
Instead, they went after the people who were sharing it, and they weren't even selling it, you know? Right. Like there was never bootlegs. Hey, there were bootlegs, right? I mean, remember? There were bootlegs when there were real records, when there was vinyl.
They bootlegged our own record. That's why Tonight I Fell in Love didn't have the numbers that it was supposed to have, because they were backdooring records and not paying us for them.
So there's a big difference, as we always said here from the beginning, a big difference in piracy and sharing. I mean, these kids weren't going out and selling things. They were just acquiring this music, and the industry didn't know how to do it, didn't know how to handle it. But go ahead.
They're so backwards. It's the same thing with drugs. The same nonsense. Mm-hmm. It's nonsense. They put a kid in jail for having an ounce or 2 ounces of pot. It's absurd.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Well, speaking of what the internet did, in that sense, now let's move on to you as an author. When you start writing books, how did this start? And of course, that industry is completely different also now.
Well, here's what happened. The story about me you don't know is when I came out to California in 1978, I became, and I won't get into the whole story, I became the manager of Robert Guillaume, who played Benson on Benson and on Soap.
Ah, okay. I know. Sure. Okay.
And because of that, I had inroads to television. I would sit in the green room with all of the hot shots from the network, and I would say, look, I got this idea. And they'd say, oh, that's a good idea. Let's develop it. And they would bring a writer in, and the writer would do it, and it sucked, and it went away. So the next time I got an idea, I said, look, let me develop it. Let me write it. You're not a writer. I said, so give me a shot at it, and if it's no good, then you cut it. If it's good, and pay me minimum, and if it's good and it gets to production, then you can pay me a good fee, and I'll produce it, right? So sure enough, the next thing I brought in, I wound up writing with the fellow I was writing with, and it went to script, and then it went to production, and we made the movie. And I made movies, I produced and wrote movies of the week.
What movie was that first movie?
The first one was Gary Coleman. We did two Gary Coleman movies.
Okay.
I did the famous Vanna White movie, Goddess of Love.
Oh.
I did a whole bunch of TV movies. I wrote the last episode of Love Boat with the original crew.
Okay.
And I became a television writer.
Man.
And I became a television producer. So that led me to, and I got a chance to write in the series. They did a short series of Four Seasons that Alan Alda did as a motion picture.
Right.
And I got to work with Alan, who was wonderful and taught me so much about writing. And I got to work with real professional people. And I learned how to direct, and I learned how to write, and I learned how to produce. I learned all those things in that period of time that I was with Robert. And then as time went by, I didn't have contact with the people, you know, the people I knew weren't in charge anymore. So it was hard for me to make any deals in television. So I had this one idea. I wanted to do a story about based on the fact that this planet we live on is really 40 billion years old, not 4.5. And there have been 28 previous configurations of intelligent life on it that rose from the slime and perished either by their own means or by an outside source. And we're the 29th. And I called it the null quotient. And I try to find people in television I could bring it to, and there was no one to bring it to. So I had a friend of mine has a friend who was an editor, and I wrote up 30 pages or something, 50 pages, and I sent it to them. I said, you think there's a book here? And they said, yes. So I wrote it. I sat down, and for a year and a half, I wrote this novel. And I couldn't be prouder of it. And it's out there, it's selling a little, and it gets some very nice reviews. You know, there are people that don't like it too. I mean, that's life.
So when did you start? What year is that?
Well, it's about last year.
Oh, okay. All right. So then, you're saying all the other stuff has dried up. What's the television? Here's what I heard. A lot of the guys who were writing sitcoms and stuff back there when I was out there and, like in the 70s, late 70s and 80s, a lot of these guys can't even get work anymore because the young kid, the young executives aren't even, they don't even want to give anybody with those experiences from the 70s and 80s, not giving them any work. How's that climate?
It's true. It's absolutely true. It's called ageism and it's true. And a lot of competent people are not working because of some stupid belief that you forget how to write a sentence, you know,
Well, where are these new people coming? Where are these young people coming from that are taking the place of veterans?
All over, wherever they always came from. And there are a lot of veterans that are still making pictures. I mean, Steven Spielberg still makes pictures. You know, sure. It's very selective
But I'm talking about those workhorses, you know, the guys, you know, a lot of people don't even know their names, people who did, you know, sitcoms and made it a lot of, what?
It's showrunners, right. Showrunners,
yeah. They're called. Yeah, there are a lot of them.
They come from other shows that they've written on for staff or something. Mm. They become producers on their own. But the fact of the matter is that you know, it's funny because this book got me an agent again.
Mm.
You know, it's weird how life works. I mean, I'm 70 years old and I have an agent. You know?
Well, you do need somebody to run that stuff through.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the fact of the matter is that it was interesting enough for them to get involved with. So we'll see. You know, my son and I have written a play.
Mm-hmm.
I did a movie called Goddess of Love with Vanna White. We went back to that original book and wrote a musical around. And I have some very, very real interest from some serious quarters now. So who knows? That might happen. It's called Oh My Goddess.
Isn't it amazing how, people see a film, a movie or what have you, and they have no idea the evolution of any project and that there's something coming out that looks fresh and exciting, and people have been working on it on and off, and it's been through like tens of hands here in like 9-10 years. It's amazing, isn't it? People don't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Goddess of Love. I started pitching it 10 years before I finally made a deal on it.
What do you like? What do you intend to do now? I mean, you want to make that into, you want to produce it? You want to go all the way with this and be the, or you just want to write more books, sit back and let other people handle it?
I'm writing a book now called Superhero School.
Okay.
With my son, which is going to be available probably on, by the way, the Null Quotient is available at Barnes & Noble. On Barnes & Noble online, on Amazon online, and on Kindle, and on Nook, and it's a good read. I mean, we got a lot of nice reviews on it, and I'm really excited about it because I know there's an audience for it if I can get it out there more, you know. I just don't have the time to do all that because I'm involved in so many other things. You know, I didn't even tell you about the inventing part. That's a whole different thing. That's for another interview.
Yeah.
But anyway, I enjoy what I'm doing. I get a chance to make up stories. I get a chance to stand in front of people and sing. How lucky am I?
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. Now, you're an old analog dog like I am. We, you know, doing a lot of stuff before the zeros and ones took over the whole picture and did whatever they did for better or for worse. But I know I didn't think in those days. Well, when they were first, the days when people said, you know, we have 8-track now. And it was like, holy crap, you're kidding me. 8? You know, you're just getting used to 4. But in those days, I didn't have any idea of the kind of stuff that would be going on right now. Here's the perfect example. Someone who writes science fiction told me a while ago, they said, you know what's fascinating? Gene Roddenberry. Right, Gene Roddenberry comes up with Star Trek, and it turns out to be, you know, it's a phenomenon. Okay, the TV goes, but it's a phenomenon. Okay, but you look at Star Trek, which is supposed to be Stardate, what, 21, 30, 20, right? And someone said, where's the internet? They had no, it's like nobody even forecasted. They were still in those ships. There were all the big knobs like you had in your, you know, your recording. It was like, there was all analog based. Nobody thought beyond, into the math of digital math and technology. It's amazing. And did you have any idea what was going on? I mean, that it was just going to get better as an analog, but did you have any idea this would change so much technology?
This
happened in our lifetime. That's amazing. I mean, you know, like in our grandfathers, I know that my grandfather, you know, less happened in his time, even though some great things happened, air cars or whatever. Less happened in that time than it happened in the life progress-wise and technology-wise than has happened in our lifetime. We've seen a lot of gigantic turnovers.
My answer to your question is yes, and here's how I can tell you. There was an episode of The Outer Limits, the original Outer Limits, okay, back in the 60s, was it the early 60s,
yeah,
maybe? And Robert Culp played this character who was supposedly the last living creature on Earth. And this, it was a three-parter or a two-parter, but the whole, the upshot of it was in his finger, he had the whole population of the world on a wire, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that sound like?
Yeah, it sounds like a chip, having all this gigantic pieces of information on a chip, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that idea was introduced in An Outer Limits 50 years ago or more, okay? I think it was at least 50 years ago. You gotta see if you can find that episode. It's a two or three parter with Robert Culp. Yeah. I forgot the title of it, but you look up Outer Limits Robert Culp. He did a few of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this one, he plays this agent that's the last living person on Earth. And then he finds another one, and these aliens are trying to kill him. And the bottom line is they're killing him to get his finger, which at the end detaches, yeah, and he brings everybody back to life.
Well, the writer of that script is who we have to talk to and say, hey, what was that? You know, did you have any idea this was going to turn into this or what? I wonder if Steve Jobs or Gates saw this thing.
Look at the communicator on Star Trek, and it was just a communicator. There was no visual.
Right, right.
You know, and he flipped it open. Where's the screen? How come you can't see the guy up on the ship?
It's amazing. It's amazing how science fiction is. Well, obviously, this has all changed science fiction. I'm not up to date with what's happening today in terms of hip science fiction and what's going on. The genre, obviously, is still out there. But it's got to be an incredibly different thing, even from the Harlan Ellison days, right? I mean, it's got to be an incredibly different thing.
Well, as the Asimov and all of them, they all, you know, Robert Heinlein, you know, if you ever get my book or whatever, if you ever, you'll see each chapter has the name of a famous science fiction work as its head. Oh, and everything in that chapter relates to what that title is, you know? So you'll see, it's kind of fun. It's like I have chapters called The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, paying homage to all these great writers and these great creators and these great works of science fiction.
So you got to, I see on your, no one else can see because you're not on there, but back on those shelves there, we got a lot of Ray Bradbury. What else have we got back there? We got, what else do we have?
H.G. Wells, Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, see the originals. So see, you went for the roots because you and I know the roots from way back.
But now, on my Kindle, I have the whole collection at my fingertips.
That's right.
And yeah. H.G. Wells and Jules Verne cost me $3 each one, and I got them all. Everything, even their essays.
And that's why great generations of H.G. Wells kids are starving.
Because
the royalties didn't go, and the copyrights gave up, right?
I just finally got an iPad, and my 5-year-old granddaughter is teaching me how to use it.
Oh, ain't that the truth, huh?
Huh?
Yeah, that's the truth. See, then these children are not going to have, that's what I mean, their world, their consciousness of growing up with this stuff really changes.
Well, yes, it is, but you know, the problem is,
it changes the future.
School is getting worse. You know, I mean, in Beverly Hills, it's not. In Beverly Hills, it's, you know, they make a concerted effort, and there's a lot of money here to take the place of the money that the schools aren't getting. And nobody, my son has actually just been elected to the school board. So nobody's going to, you know, they're not going to allow anything to happen to the schools here. But by and large, in this country, there's not enough teachers. And, you know, it's, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm a little concerned. But anyway, whatever it is, you can bet your butt that I'll fight it as long as I can stand. You know? And, you know, and the book, And the book has some, you know, has some lefty, you know, real left-leaning concepts, you know. Like, you know, these silly concepts like treat each other nice, you know.
Right, right.
These awful way out ideas like be honorable, tell the truth, have some dignity.
You know, it was
terrible things.
I thought it was great when the, because there was always this intellectual theory, if there were people from another planet and they were, the whole day the Earth is still thing, they were intelligent. So therefore, because they were intelligent, they had precepts and concepts of peace and understanding and stuff that we didn't know about. And so, they would try to teach us because we were the tribe out in the jungle or what have you, and they were the mega intelligence of the universe. And then along came that movie Independence Day, where it was like they just turned it all over, and they said, yeah, we have the technology and we have all this and we're a lot better than you guys, and we're going to eat you. Right. Destroy you. It was an entirely different, that was time to turn it around, you know?
It's War of the Worlds, you know, basically it was War
yes,
of the Worlds.
Yes, you're right, yeah, yeah.
And basically, most aliens in most movies were depicted as evil who were going to blow us up. Very few, like for example, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Clark 2, was a guy who said, look, stop screwing around or we are going to blow you up.
Yeah, right.
But this is a warning. Straighten up and fly right, because we're not going to let your nonsense be inflicted upon the rest of us.
Right, but that judgmental dictum, that thing that says, look, you're going to screw up the universe. We know better than you and we're smart. And if we have to blow you up to get rid of you, we'll do that. That's a lot different than the guys from that even War of the Worlds.
Yes. Well, yeah. I know. I'm saying that. Yeah. That was unique.
Yes.
That's the unique thing. And he had every reason to be concerned about them, because we are capable of launching nuclear weapons into space. You know, all of those things that Klaatu was worried about, you know, that Michael Rennie played the part. We do have the capability of doing that. We can blow up our own planet. We can blow up other planets, you know?
Something like the War of the Worlds, which is 18-something or other, right? That Welles wrote that, H.G. Welles, 18-something. And then, you know, Spielberg redoes it with his little spin a couple of years ago.
Right.
And so this thing holds up. H.G. Welles, that thing holds up without a lot of translating into the digital world. It's basically the same story, and they die the same way, and everything happens. That really stands up. Do you think there's stuff that can be written today that would stand up as quickly as technology is turning over and changing and getting deeper and deeper into our lives? Do you think that something written today could stand up in 100 years?
Well, as a person who did something that got halfway there, I say yes. Blind Seeds Tonight is 51 years old. That's a half a century. Mm-hmm. It still stands up. I played you the card. You know, it's still in movies. It still exists.
Hey,
so yes, the answer is definitely yes.
Okay. Okay.
Without a doubt. Why not? I mean, do I think that science fiction today will have an impact in the future? Yes, it will. Certainly. Certainly. I mean, H.G. Wells and Jules Verne did back then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, H.G. Wells died in 1946.
Right.
And so he was like almost part of the night of the 20th century. Jules Verne was in the 1800s.
Right. Okay, that's right. Yeah, you're right. H.G. Wells was, you're absolutely correct.
H.G. Wells was on the cusp, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wrote Time Machine and War of the World and Time Machine and War of the Worlds and The Invisible Man. You know, he wrote a bunch of stuff. But
and Jules Verne, for all due purposes, invented the submarine, didn't he?
Well, he didn't invent it. He invented the nuclear submarine.
Yeah,
there was a submarine during the Civil War. They had, you know.
Which one was that? Was that the Monitor or the Merrimack?
No, the Monitor and Merrimack were ironclad ships.
Oh, they were ships.
Exactly.
Okay.
There was actually a submarine that they found and dug up out of the mud, mm-hmm, in wherever it was sunk originally. You look back at Civil War submarine Navy, U.S. Navy or Union Navy, you'll see that it was in the 1860s that the idea of a submergible. And I think Da Vinci had the idea of a submersible boat back in, you know, in the 1600s right. or whatever it was.
Right.
These ideas, you know, the ideas like these, I mean, and computers and stuff like that, will go back to Roman and Greek times. You know, we don't know what was lost in the library at Alexandria, but there must have been some amazing things that they had discovered. You know?
Yeah.
They were very curious people, and they were very scientific, and education was very important. And when education is important, things happen. You know, just look at the Silicon Valley, what happened there.
I didn't look into this history at all, but it just dawned on me now. I had no idea I was going to ask this question. But I'm trying to think, here's The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which is one of these rare, situations where the actual recording is not really the song as much as it is the production and presentation of these words and music and all this stuff. Because, and I'm saying this because, I can't even remember anybody doing it, anyone else doing it. Has there been any covers? Have there been any covers of this?
Yes, we produced a version with Robert John in 1970 that went to number one.
I see. I didn't even know this. Robert John. There's a name coming out of absolutely nowhere.
That's funny. It's one of the number one records we produced, and I never even mentioned it.
Yeah. But
Robert John did The Lion Sleeps Tonight in 1970, and it went to number one again. So the answer is yes.
Yeah, and there's one that just escaped me totally, because every time I'm thinking of that song, all I do is hear the original in my head. I never hear anybody else. Now he did it very much. We're gonna have to look this up and play it or somewhere. You
know, we tried to get Lou Christie to do it, and he didn't want.
Oh, Lou, my old pal Lou. Yeah, well, he didn't want to do. He didn't want to go up there.
Ask him to talk to him.
He's still out there, you know. He's still out there doing this stuff. There.
Well, ask him. He'll tell you that.
I don't think he'll talk to me anymore.
So we did it with Robert John. But the fact of the matter is that it is the song. Because it's not the lyric necessarily, but it's the melody, which is so infectious. Mm-hmm. And it's like one of the top earworms. You know what an earworm is?
Yeah.
That gets in your ear and you can't stop thinking about it. The Lion Sleeps Tonight is one of the top ones of all time.
Who else did it? Do you know anyone else who covered it, put it on albums or things? Or is there a lot of activity with that?
Nylons.
The who?
The Nylons.
The Nylons did it. I don't even know the Nylons. Boy, that record had legs, huh?
Yeah. No, I mean, it had hundreds of covers. Hundreds.
Hundreds of covers. I'm going to have to look that up because I just thought about it now. I should have, that's like, wow, because there's, like I said, it's a song that everyone, I think most people remember it because of the rendition and the actual sound of that. Did you try to recreate that in 70? What did you do differently, or what did you think you should do differently? Because you obviously do something differently. Why do it again?
Don't lie.
Huh?
Don't lie. Do it honest. Do it straight.
Well, with Robert John, I mean, how? How is it? What, do it?
Just how he does it. Oh, what we did was we used the girls group to sing the Whimaways.
Okay.
Used a tuba to do the solo. But It wouldn't have mattered if we used a kazoo. It wouldn't have mattered. The song has that, the song itself, melodically and even lyrically, because the lyrics were so stunning and unique. And because I think, you know, everybody said what kind of song it is. And if you ask me, Phil, what kind of song is it? It's a lullaby.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you saw the movie, what was the movie with John? Matinee. There was a movie with John Goodman called Matinee.
Oh, that was Joe Dante's movie.
Okay.
Joe Dante directed. I knew Joe when I was out there. Sure. Joe Dante's movie, Ratney, with Goodman and also that girl who played in Raging Bull. What was her name?
Kathy Moriarty.
Yeah. Of course, I had seen that. Yes.
Right. Well, if you ever see it again, they use The Lion Sleeps Tonight at the end of the movie.
Wow, I didn't even remember that. Wow.
After the missile crisis was over, and it's saying in the village, the quiet, near the village, the lion sleeps tonight. It's a song that allays your fear. Mm-hmm. Everything is okay. It's going to be all right. You know, because at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the lion went back to sleep.
Mm.
The danger was past, you know. So they use it in the exact right way.
Yeah, yes, it does, of course, have that metaphor and that theme to it. That makes total sense. The lion himself has become a figure of whatever, of that whole thing. King of the jungle. Even then, right, they called him King of the Jungle. You don't even live in the jungle. Look at Lion King.
The last verse, hush, my darling, don't fear, my darling.
Mm-hmm.
The lion sleeps tonight.
And once he gets up,
tonight, the roses, lilies, lay me down, now you rest, may your slumber be blessed. It's the same idea, you know. It really is. It's the same idea, and it's a lullaby, and that's what I tell everybody.
So the Weavers version, they were doing Wimowep? They were doing, they just had this old African chant or something?
Just the chant, no lyric.
That must have been weird. I mean, how many did this go on for, like, the Weavers were...
Look up the Weavers record, you'll be surprised to hear it.
Yeah, I will, because it just goes on Wimowep for, like, how long?
1952, I think.
Mm. What do you, you like me, you've been through decades of this stuff, like I have, and, what do you look back? We realized there was chicanery and there was, people got screwed in the record business. There was all sorts of stuff and everything, but, what do you look back on as moments that you hold on to and that that really makes you proud to have gotten where you've gotten and do what you do and still be able to sit down and say, I love what I do and I've always loved what I did and I've been a very fortunate person. What are the best elements going traveling that trip?
It's so many. We're in the studio ready to do He So Fine with the Chiffons. They're on mic. I'm playing drums. I kick it off. I play four bars at the top. And then Judy starts singing He's So Fine. The girls come in, do-lang, 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 you know. And the engineer, Johnny Q Galo, stops the tape. He says, wait. He says, that do-lang thing is cute. Why don't you start with it? And I said, okay, girls, you got it? Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
There's those magic moments. Who wrote He's So Fine?
What?
Who wrote it?
Oh, Ronnie Mack.
Okay, Ronnie Mack. Is he the guy who sued George Harrison?
No.
Who sued George Harrison for My Sweet Lord on that?
He did.
You did? That was you guys.
He published it. Yeah, we owned the publishing on He's So Fine.
That was a weird thing because everybody, you know, we all heard it. And when those of us who knew it said, hey, that sounds a lot like He's So Fine. But I certainly don't think Mr. Harrison sat back and did this consciously. Do you? Do you think? I mean, how do you prove plagiarism?
Because
you won, right?
We won the case, but we didn't win punitives because we didn't. Well, we had sold the copyright after we won the case, but George Harrison went on, took the stand, and he convinced the judge that he didn't know. But the truth is that Phil Spector was involved in it, and he did know.
Phil Spector was, oh, that's right, because he produced.
And he knew He's So Fine very well because we were very good friends with Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich, who wrote the Crystal stuff and wrote Be My Baby, and we all knew each other, and Phil Spector damn well knew what we did. So for him to not, for him, you know, and they never brought him in to testify.
Yeah, well, you know, he was that's quite a character, Mr. Spector. I don't know if they, I mean, who knows what he knew at that time. Wasn't he pretty much on the edge around the time he was dealing with Harrison at that time too?
He made My Sweet Lord. How far on the edge could he have been?
Oh, well, because he had all the help of Harrison, who had learned from George Martin and had a tremendous amount of input in all that stuff.
Then why would you bring in Phil Spector?
You know, I never understood that either, because remember, the Beatles brought him in at the end, and that really helped the schism also, because nobody wanted, they didn't want him in there, and George Martin, of course, had taken, I don't know. I think that's because Lennon got involved with him.
I had the pleasure of having lunch with George Martin,
mm-hmm.
and he was a delight.
Isn't he? Yeah, I knew him too. Yeah, he was a wonderful guy, huh?
He told me everything I asked him. He was wonderful. I had the Beverly Hills Hotel.
That's exactly where I, yes, I, that's exactly where I hung out with him. What year was that?
God, I don't remember.
Yeah, wow, okay.
So he was involved in Airedale. He was involved with a friend of mine in a business in London that did commercials and stuff.
Oh, okay, must have been later then.
But he was such a gentleman.
Wasn't he? Yeah.
I mean, you know, you get to meet people along the way that are really worth knowing. And, you know, and that was a great moment for me. There are a lot of great moments. I mean, when I heard Candida for the first time and said, this is a hit song. Or when Carole King called me up and says, I have a perfect follow-up for the show for He's So Fine. And she said, I'm going to send you a demo over. And she sends me, you know, a demo with Little Eva singing the demo, One Fine Day. Mm. And I said, okay, I'll take it, but I want the track. And I used that track with her piano on it. And I added, you know, I added a bass and a saxophone solo and the Shoo-Bee-Doo Wah-Wahs and all of that stuff. And we had a 2-foot part follow-up.
So, you know, before you knew that you were going to get into this and you were singing and stuff, or you had any encouragement, you used to sit and listen to, take apart songs and yes. that you heard and everything like that. But so then who would you consider, if you had to name like two or three of your, of influences, and that is that artists or arrangers or whatever, that you always seem to know you can trust, although along the way you said, you know what would Henry Mancini do, or what would this, that, or the other thing? Who are two or three that really stuck with you through all this work?
I never had anybody that I said, what would they do, or what would they do? I didn't have that, but...
No, but we don't do those things consciously, but I mean, we have so many influences that this stuff goes on. What was the biggest influence, do you think, from who?
Biggest influences on me as a singer and as an artist was Dion and the Belmonts.
They're from the Bronx, aren't they?
I love the way he sang. Mm. I love their records, their arrangements. Okay.
Who arranged their stuff? With
they were Laurie. It was Laurie.
It was all the Laurie people, huh? That whole group.
I guess the group must have done it. I don't know. I never really. I only met Dion once. Mm. Their songs, "Teenager in Love" and right. "Wonder Why," really had an impact on me. Ray Charles really had an impact on me. You know, artists like that. I wouldn't put myself in their place to say, what would they do? I pretty much act on my own belief. But Mitchell, when my brothers, we had Sue in September with the Happenings, and we had to do a follow-up, and we were having a meeting with them, and Mitchell stands up and says, do I got rhythm? And everybody laughed. And I said, talk to me. How? And he says, oh, we don't. And, oh, and Bobby Miranda said, you mean I got rhythm, I got music. And I said, no. And he said, no, in fours, do it in fours. Come up with a nice, you know, syllable riff line. And we sent them away, and they came back with the whole arrangement. Happenings did.
Yeah, that's right. That was the other Happenings song, Gershwin's piece there.
So when we mixed it and we were leaving the studio, I said, guys, guarantee number one record. Guaranteed, I guarantee it. And it was. That was one of three records that I thought would absolutely be hits that we made.
What's the biggest bomb?
The three records are One Fine Day, I Knew It Was Going to Be a Hit,
right.
I Got Rhythm, and Knock Three Times.
And what was the biggest bomb? That you, no, I'll just this way. Let's not look at it that way. What is the one big disappointment? What song you said, I wanted this one to go, and that's the one I want. I still think... Something, how did I, what? Which one?
A couple of them.
Okay, give a couple.
I Hear Trumpets Blow, which if New York would have started playing, it would have been a top 10 record. We couldn't get them to play it, our own city. The great record was number one in Boston, you know. There was every reason why that record should have been played, but BT Puppy was a small label and they couldn't get it where they needed to get it. And also, another record like that was He's in Town, which is a song that Carole King and Jerry Goffin wrote. That was disappointing. Mm. And also what was disappointing is we went the wrong way after we did The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
Yeah. What was your next one?
Instead of listening to ourselves.
What were you going to do right after that?
We never got the chance to talk about it because they came up with this album of all these songs, which was really not in the spirit of what The Lion Sleeps Tonight was. Mm. You know? Lion Sleeps Tonight, we came to them with it. We said, here's the way we should do it, so on and so forth. These other things, they came to us with the song, and it was a mistake.
Yeah.
I should have known better. But again, we were young. We didn't know that much, you know. We didn't know as much. I guess I didn't have the knowledge to be able to guide that ship the way it it should have been guided, and that's my disappointment. Because years and years later, Paul Simon did that.
With,
he took the African songs,
yes,
and he made it into something memorable and wonderful. And that's, and he said, I owe the tokens for that because they did the Lion Sleeps Tonight. Well, yeah, why didn't we do that? You know.
Well,
so,
yeah,
that,
well,
if you, but they're not regrets. Well, I regret nothing. I had a ball.
Yeah.
I am the luckiest person in the world. I had a ball, and I have no regrets. But if you're asking me the things that, that stick a little, those are them.
That's good. And I appreciate your being real honest. Tell us about the book. Tell everybody about the book again. Give them the name of the book. We know, everybody knows where to get books. We don't have to tell them. We know they're all over the place. Give the name of the book.
Yes, the name of the book is The Null Quotient. NullQuotient.
Null Quotient, friends.
Null Quotient, yeah. And basically, it's a, it's kind of a legal term, which
like null and void.
Because, like null and void, because what happens is after each of these configurations of life is destroyed, the planet is set back, you know, it's the delete button is pressed and it's set back to the slime so that a whole new kind of creature, intelligent creature is born so that it wouldn't be picking up the nonsense from the last group. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's on, and it's available on Kindle. It's available on Nook. It's available on Barnes and Noble online and Amazon online. And you could, and our website is thetokens.com where you can get all that information.
Yeah.
And you could see some of the videos that we've done. Like we did a video of The Lion Sleeps Tonight and some of the other songs that we've done. There's a lot of stuff on the website that people would enjoy.
Well, my audience is very investigative, and they keep notes as we do, as we and then they go and look all this stuff up, and I'm sure a lot more people, younger people, are going to know about the tokens than did before. Philip, thank you very much for giving us your time and your knowledge and experience. It's been a delight. And
yes, extremely a delight. It was wonderful.
And
you asked the right questions, too.
Well, thank you. We'll have another talk again, and people will enjoy it some other time. I really appreciate it. Say hello to that great town out there. Maybe
it's
I'll come back someday.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Frank.
Okay.
Happy day. And Wimaways.
Yes, Wimaways to you, too. Thank you, Mr. Margo. Good night.
Good night, Mr. Margo. Yeah, that was wonderful. I hope he's doing well, and you can still get that book, I'm sure, that all this stuff goes on here, and there you go. And now here we are again. And here we go again, I guess. I think you know the drill by now. We all do. We're all in this together, right? This is a global thing. Hey, let's get that lion to sleep. What do you say? Good night, Mrs. Earthswhile, wherever you may be located on this wonderful time. Check out. You know where to go. You know what to do. Do it. Stay well. Wash your hands. You know the drill, I guess, and that's the whole thing. I'm still taking in some of that stuff. But there's a lot of stuff. And, what can I say when I have nothing more to say?